Every company has values, core values especially. So core values are different than values. So values are just a set of things, honesty, integrity, service, whatever. And then core values are the few that are immutable and inviolable, right? They're the ones that you put litmus tests to. And to me, there are three litmus tests that I've learned over the years that work well. One is that would you fire someone if they violated it? Maybe not the first time, but definitely the second time. The second is, would you take a financial hit to protect the value? And then lastly is, do you live them every day? You know, are you putting people in situations, you know, are you rewarding good values? Are you doing special events or things that really promote values, etc., of your company?
Welcome to the Hands On Business Podcast. Where else are you going to come to get tips, tricks, and advice on growing your business? As you know, what people tend to love about this podcast is that it is a place where you can hear real business leaders discussing systems, methodologies, and strategies that they have used to help them catapult growth in their business. So I'm your podcast host, Hakeem Adebiyi, and I've grown several small businesses to multi-million pound enterprises and noticed that there wasn't really a place to focus on where I was, i.e. growing a small business. All of the content that seemed to be out there was about big business and often just a lot of theory and no practical implementable advice, which is exactly why I set up this podcast. So take a listen, enjoy, and start implementing the strategies that you hear on the podcast. Happy listening. I've often talked about the fact that I believe the most important thing in business is its people. And I've consulted with and grown numerous businesses over the years, and I've never saw any really show exponential growth or continually thrive without good people. And if you've been watching me, I've done a few short videos on the topic recently, but I decided it would be a perfect time to have a more in-depth discussion about this, i.e., you know, how do you attract, train, and retain talent into your organization? So as always on the Hands On Business Podcast, I go and find an industry expert who can help illuminate the matter for you at my discerning audience. So enter Bill Flynn, author of the best-selling book, Further Faster, The Vital Few Steps That Take the Guesswork Out of Growth. He's been described as the pragmatic Simon Sinek, so we're definitely going to ask him about that. He's collaborated with Alan Mulally, number three on Fortune's list of world's greatest leaders, just in case you haven't heard of him. I'm not sure where you've been, but if just in case you haven't. And he also once pitched to Steve Jobs. So welcome, Bill. Thank you very much for agreeing to be on the show.
Thanks, Hakeem. Great to be here. And I like to say at the outset, is I like the word expertise versus expert. I don't consider myself an expert in anything. I'm a student more than an expert of anything.
Good distinction. Very good distinction. So, I mean, I said that in the intro that you've been described as the pragmatic Simon Sinek. So when people have said that, or when a person said that, what do you think they actually meant by that particular statement?
Yeah, actually, I'm more self-described as a pragmatic Simon Sinek. So Simon Sinek is an optimist. He's a self-proclaimed optimist, which I am as well. But I'm also an operator. I've done, you know, 10 startups. I've worked at almost 20 companies over 30 or so years. And I've been working with dozens of others in either as a consultant, advisor, or as a coach.
Okay, so in other words, what you're saying is that you're an optimist but a realist, and your basic experience is based and rooted in real business and real business transformations. Yeah, okay. So that makes
More perfect. Definitely an operator.
Excellent. And then the other, obviously, the one that would have pricked people's mind is obviously Alan Mulally and the Steve Jobs, but everyone talks about Steve Jobs all the time. So how did that actually come about, the pitching to Steve Jobs?
Oh, so I worked for a company that did speech recognition in the early 90s. And we had a relationship with Microsoft and some other large companies as well. And I was in charge of the West Coast. So I spent a lot of time on 101, driving up and down 101. Talking to software developing companies, hardware manufacturers, etc. And I got an appointment at Next, which was the company that Steve Jobs did in between Apple, his two terms at Apple, if you will. And so I showed up just as I do with anyone. I brought my It wasn't a laptop. There were no laptops then. It was called a lunchbox. It was this big sort of toolbox looking thing that you had that the screen popped out of, which was cutting edge at the time. I think it had kilobytes of memory in it. So it was a long time ago. So I showed up at Next and met the person that I was talking with. And there were two of them in the product group. So I sat down in the office and I was setting up, and they said, "Oh, you know, we're going to start a little bit later. Steve might join us." So at this point, Steve Jobs wasn't in the conversation. I didn't know who Steve was, who this Steve was. I thought, I started to get a little nervous. I'm like, did I forget someone I spoke to? Who's this Steve guy they're talking about? And I try to go back in my memory. And was doing that, in walked Steve Jobs through the door, and he just sat down across from me, and we was probably there for 20, 25 minutes, went through, asked me a whole bunch of questions, asked for a demonstration, and then said, "Great." He just wanted an update on where the technology was. This was, well before the internet, and the web was something that people use for it to gather information. So it was an interesting and rather non-newsworthy discussion, and which is probably good, because I had family and friends that worked for Steve Jobs and at Apple during his first time there, and I had heard the stories from them directly, so I probably would have been a little more nervous. But he was very pleasant, very polite, and we had a great conversation, and he said thank you, and off he went.
Okay, so rather uneventful in terms of the actual meeting itself, but I suppose still quite memorable because everybody's heard of Steve Jobs, and as you said, very few people would have had a meeting with Steve Jobs. And the burning question is, did you manage to sell your services and the product to him, or did he not?
Very good question. No, actually, and I don't think very much after that he went back to Apple. Anyway, so there was nothing. It was hard to sell speech recognition to those large name manufacturers at that time. We only had a few relationships with folks. So it was still early days in speech recognition. It was like 1990, I don't know, 3 or 4, I think, when I met him.
Okay, yeah. So, you've still got a story to tell. The great-grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, as you said, there's not that many people. So if we get into the meat of the topic, obviously we're looking at talking about people and how people are important. The key qualities or key things that you look for, because you've obviously worked in a lot of businesses, when you try to attract the right talent, because that would seem to me to be the first part, isn't it? We talk about development, but you want to attract the right people into the organization in the first place. What are the sort of things that you'd say that over the years you've looked for then lead to success?
So I've done this myself, and I've done this with my clients as well. Actually, I had a gentleman who was having a hard time finding a particular person for a role, and he was going to what he thought was the right places, which seemed okay, but he wasn't really saying the right things. So what you're looking for two things. You're looking for a fit in terms of, are they someone that really believes what I believe and will help me to do the things I need to do to get there, more on sort of values and that type of thing. And then of course you have skill. And what I've learned is that hiring for skill is typically what our default is. And because we want people to hit the ground running, it makes it easier on us, et cetera. But unfortunately, when you're interviewing someone, the person that you're interviewing isn't the same person that comes to work 3 or 4 months later once they're relaxed and sort of are themselves. They're putting their best face on. I have interviewed hundreds of salespeople. I was a head of sales most of my career. And salespeople are the best interviewers on the planet. They are really good at reading body language and, tone of voice and whatever. And they're really good at knowing what to say to sort of get the deal done, if you will. So I think what's important, you want to hire for a minimum amount of skill. And then if you get more than that, great. I would consider that gravy, if you will. But you really want to hire for values, behaviors, things that you want them to be, or you're hoping them to be, when they show up. And that's really difficult to do in an interview because you only see the true behavior of someone when they're in the situation. So if as much as you can do, you want to advertise, if you will, in some way, shape or form, the kind of people that you want, right? So, share the values of your company, what you're what you're all about, how you expect people to behave, especially your core values. And then I think you have to say sort of, here's what's in it for you, and here's what's expected of you. And if this is who you are, then come on in and let's have a chat. Most people don't do that. They describe the job. You know, there are bullets and bullets, a dozen, you know, 20 bullets of all the, here's all the things you need to know how to do, et cetera. And, you know, one, people can't remember more than three or four things anyway. And two, it's in the end, you can teach them most of those things. There's certain fundamental things that you need them how to do. But, you know, so I think to attract them, you have to do that. And then you have to understand what I've definitely come to learn. And I learned this myself as an interviewer, is the worst way to hire someone is through an interview, through a talking interview, a standard interview. Why? Because we have about 150 or so unconscious biases that we bring with us to every interaction. And, you know, they're unconscious. So you don't even know that immediately your brain is saying friend or foe. And if they're friend, then you treat them differently than if your brain says they're foe. And you don't know why your brain is doing that. Most likely because they remind you of someone in your past. And if there was someone in your past that looked like them or talked like them or whatever, you immediately like them. And again, this is unconscious. And if it's someone that you don't, it was a negative influence in your past, you immediately dislike them or distrust them. And the tenor of the conversation is driven by that initial interaction with the person, which clearly is not what you want, right? You want to interview everyone exactly the same way, so then you can sort of assess and see which ones are the right fit, et cetera. So you're having all of these issues anyway with an interview. So people ask me this all the time. It's funny, I was at dinner the other day and someone said, what is the best way to sort of interview a candidate for this? And the best way to interview that I've found from my own work and from the research I've done is to basically find candidates, you know, quickly that you believe have the right values and have at least a minimum skill set, and then hire them and put them in the situation. And, you know, I always say hire the top two candidates and then sort of see how they go and then see what happens. Because you won't really understand how they're going to behave, how they're going to interact with other people, et cetera, until they're in that situation. Now, that's not always practical. So what I did was I completely changed my interview process. So I was taught how to interview in sort of the basic way, create the resume and then sort of walk through the resume, ask a few questions, ask for some case studies or examples, et cetera. And that was fine. And I, you know, I probably had about a 50 to 60% hit rate, which by the way is about average, according to some data. But I didn't like that because salespeople were expensive. You really didn't know for 3 to 6 months whether they're going to perform well or not. So I said, you know, so how do I want to do this? And since I knew there were certain characteristics I was looking for from the salesperson, and there were certain skills. So what I basically did was I said to the people who were helping me hire, I said, look, I only want to talk to the number one or number two sales rep at a particular company that did it twice. So they had to be the number one or number two sales rep at least twice at different companies. So that at least got me some comfort level that they were had a level of expertise, that they were at least successful at selling something. And then I changed my interview process to say, what are the characteristics I'm looking for? So there were three characteristics I was looking for. I want people who are curious. You know, salespeople have to be curious. They have to be compassionate, which to me, my definition of compassion is empathy with action. So they have to be able to care about trying to see something from someone else's perspective and be willing to take action on that. And then lastly, I sort of called it entrepreneurial or whatever, but I'm mostly hiring for startups. So I wanted them to feel like they were owning their own business within the business. You know, they had to sort of have that drive that, hey, you know, they weren't waiting for marketing to give them something or for something to happen. They were going to make it happen. So I completely changed my interview process and started asking questions that would drive those kind of things that I could see, at least that I believed they were going to see. And I also tried to make it so it wasn't an interview that they had been able to practice for. So I tried to ask them things that I thought would be new. So for instance, one of the things that I wanted to do that I did, actually I learned this from reading the book on Google and Sergey Brin and Larry Page and how they interviewed people. They did it for a different reason, but I liked it, which was I asked them, I said at the beginning, hey, you know, we're going to go 45 minutes to an hour, whatever it is. At the end of this time, I would like you to teach me something that you know really well that you don't think I know. So what they had to be doing is through the whole interview, they had to be thinking of this in the back of their head and how to explain it, et cetera, which is what a salesperson has to do, right? They have to ask questions. And then as they're hearing the answer, they're sort of thinking forward, how am I going to do with this, you know, et cetera. And so it's definitely a skill you have to have. And there were a bunch of other questions I asked, you know, sort of off the wall questions. So at least I was getting what I thought was their off the cuff answer, right? They couldn't have already made it up and thought it through. And my hit rate went probably up to close to 90%. And so to me, that was a very unusual way. And it didn't always work. I had one guy leave in the middle of the interview. He said, that's the stupidest question I've ever heard. And he left. And I'm like, great. You know, it saved me time.
I was just going to say, yeah, because you're saying it didn't work, but it did work. If you were recruiting for values and fit, and that person obviously didn't have the values you were looking for, and they weren't a fit. So actually, I'd say, although you've done half an interview, that's the perfect thing you want to do, because they've almost like self-selected out of your organization.
Exactly. Yeah, and I didn't waste another 20, 25 minutes talking to him. He just left. So those are the things I think that people really need to think about. And they're super hard. There are companies like Zappos who really perfected it. They actually had two interviews, a cultural fit interview, where they did often put people in different kinds of situations. Even the drive from the airport, if you flew in to do them, the drive from the airport was part of the interview, but no one knew it until the book came out, Delivering Happiness. And the limo driver was part of the interview process. And he was someone that was a little developmentally delayed. And they wanted to see how the person treated him. And if they didn't treat him with respect, you know, that human beings should get, then they, you know, magically they'd show up or something and the job was filled. Right. And they said, you know, sorry, thank you for coming. We'll pay you money, reimburse your expenses, whatever. Sorry for wasting your time. So doing things like that are really interesting. I know Pat Lencioni would say that in one of his books, they talked about they wanted to make sure that the person was humble. And so the last interview for someone, they would meet with the head of the company, and the head of the company would magically have to run to the drugstore or something. And they said, hey, you know, I'm sorry about this, but it's important. Would you mind coming with me? And he wanted to see how that person acted. And if they were, you know, were sort of taken aback and, you know, insulted by the fact that they were doing this, then that was telling. Or if they were someone who said, you know, hey, you know, how can I help you? You know, what are you looking for? You know, whatever. That was a telling sign, right? Putting in a situation where they could see how humble are they truly, because everyone thinks they're humble. Everyone thinks they're great. Everyone, you know, we're the hero of our own stories. So, you know, if you ask someone if they're humble, they're going to say, of course I am, you know, but you don't really see it until you put them in the situation. So hiring for behavior is really putting them into that situation as much as you can in different ways that you can. That's, I think, the best way to attract and then bring on the right kind of people.
It's a really interesting flip on it, because even though lots of people have read the books you've read, lots of people understand that actually doing a 1-hour interview just face to face doesn't get the best results. Still, people persist in doing it. And actually, just as you were talking, I was reflecting, because we used to work for a company. This is quite early on in my career. And I remember that actually it wasn't exactly the same as the limo driver, but we used to sit them in reception, because our receptionist would seem to be very perceptive. And she used to come up after the interview and say, don't hire that person because he or she did this or did that or they said this. And that was, it wasn't necessarily something that we specifically wanted to do. We did it over a period of time because we realized actually she was very perceptive at picking the right people and picking up. But just as you said, I think once you get into an interview, you put your game face on, don't you? And you're a different person than you are when you're sitting in receptionist, getting a cup of tea, you know, speaking to receptionist. There's lots of cues which give you an idea that actually they're acting in that interview, because actually the real person was sitting outside that door, and you don't want that sort of person. So I think that's a really good starting point in terms of changing your interview and actually almost trying to knock people off kilter, because then you see the real person when they're not prepared. So that's really good. So actually there's probably a step that comes before that, isn't there? Because you talked about getting the right fit for the organization. And this is another one of my big thing, which you then need to actually understand what your fit is and what your culture is. So how do you do that? Because I know there's lots of people who talk about values. I always use Enron. Enron had integrity as one of their values. the difference between having a value and actually the behavior that is exhibited. So how do you translate between those two to make sure that actually your values are the behaviors that you see in the business before you then start trying to attract people into it.
Yeah. So what I've learned is every company has values, core values especially. So core values are different than values. So values are just a set of things, honesty, integrity, service, yeah. whatever. Yeah. And then core values are the few that are immutable and inviolable, right? They're the ones that you put litmus tests to. And to me, there are three litmus tests that I've learned over the years that work well. One is that, would you fire someone if they violated it? Maybe not the first time, but definitely the second time. The second is, would you take a financial hit to protect the value? And then lastly is, do you live them every day? You know, are you putting people in situations, you know, are you rewarding good values? Are you doing, you know, doing special events or things that really promote the values, et cetera, of your company? And I think, you know, I put this in my book because I thought it was a great example. And this was CVS. CVS used to sell cigarettes. And one of their values was the health and welfare of their customers. And it's, at one point, you know, whoever came in said, look, we're not living this. Why are we selling cigarettes? And they took cigarettes off the shelf, and they knew it would take a financial hit. But within, I think, 2 or 3 years, they not only regained that back, but more than, you know, I think they tripled the amount of bottom line impact it had. Now, it wasn't just because of cigarettes. Then they did other things that would promote health. And then we have the 1 minute clinic and all those other things that they added to the business, because they really focused on, who are we and what are we all about? And are we doing that? And how could we be doing that? So I think when you have those values and you live them, you're much more likely to think of ways to have it enhance your business and your, you know, it's really when you're taking care of your customers is typically the result is a really good business. So if you're trying to just make money as the goal, you may make money, but over time you'll make different decisions than if you were trying to change people's lives or help them with struggles, etc. So I think values is a great way to do that. So what I do with my clients is we go through an exercise and we come up with the values. They come up with the values, and we talk about actual values and aspirational values. And I think it's okay to have aspirational values, but you need to designate them as aspirational, because if you don't, just like you said with Enron, people just roll their eyes and they're like, yeah, sure, whatever, you say that, but that's not how we act. So you have to make sure that you differentiate the two, and then the aspirational eventually become the actual values. And there's typically not more than 4 to 8 in most companies. And it's interesting enough, a little side fact is, if you look at, you know, if you take 100 companies and their company values, 80% of those companies will have one of 20 values. They're the same 20 values are generally shared amongst other folks. And that's okay, but you have to make them your own. So for instance, one of my customers, they were really, it was sort of professionalism was the value, for lack of a better term. And I said, well, what does that mean to you? And they were an IT services company, and they would be in the company's offices often. Their people would be there. So what they said is, well, to us, that means you want to behave like you're in someone else's home. And so that's what they called the value. They didn't say professionalism and whatever. They said, this is what it is, because those are the words they used. So you have to make them your own. Yeah. You can do it a bunch of different ways. You can change the name of them. But as long as you have the value and then say, this is what we mean by that, you know, it's part of it. And you do those three things, right? You want to make sure that you fire someone, you'll take a hit, and you live them every day. If you don't fire someone for violating a core value within, you know, if they've done it twice, then it's really not a core value. And my guess is either you take it off the list or you change your ways.
I think that what you just said about the putting it into your words is the most important thing, because I think that's one of the easiest ways to actually live it. Anytime I've done values in an organization, obviously as you would do, you get everybody involved. So that actually, you know, so for example, I've got one which is called Get to Glasgow, and I've used that in lots of other organizations, which is great because that's what we agreed on. But now in when I work with other people, that's we will find a way, for example. So it's the same thing. And I won't go for the Get to Glasgow, but it's really about two people who are stranded. They're both brothers, and they're told their father's passed away and they have to get to Glasgow. And it's about mindset and mentality, because one of them makes lots of excuses as to why they can't get there because they're in Siberia. The other person just finds a way, trains, planes, automobiles, and gets to Glasgow. So I use that when I'm in a business to illustrate when they're talking about we can find a way or we get the job done. I think it's really important to use your own language, because then people know, actually, we'll know what we're talking about. And I think that litmus test, I think, is a really good one, because I've always thought about employing them in the business, but you know, and financial, I think just looking at those and saying, you know, if you violated that more than one, would I fire you? Because you're right, if I wouldn't, it's not a core value. It might actually be something aspirational, but it's definitely not a core value that you're living with at that particular time. So I think that's a nice way to just look at it, the litmus test and then actual versus aspirational. And then we've gone through the interview process. And is there anything, because obviously you talked about a couple of companies there, I think Google was one of them. Is there any other innovative methods that you've seen that companies do to attract top talent? Because that when we were talking about Google, that was more specifically around what they do once you're in the interview. But in terms of attracting, you know, is there anything that you've seen people do that you think, oh,
that's... The other one that I remember that I saw, which was really interesting, was it was actually Google, but you didn't know it was Google at the time. I was driving down 101 in San Francisco and San Jose, I can't remember which direction, and there was a billboard, and it had an equation on it. And they said, if you can solve this equation, call this phone number. And it was Google trying to find, you know, scientists or mathematicians or whomever that they needed. It was a very difficult equation. And that's one of the ways they attracted clients, right? So what can you do that, you know, where can you sort of advertise, if you will, the kind of person you're looking for, and how can you stand out, right? What can you do that's unusual, but also is a bit of a filter, right? For getting the right people in there. So that's an example of, you know, sort of being creative.
Yeah. And I think it comes back to what you were saying about, I think, because your example, which I quite liked as well, was just the one where if you're using a recruiter, you're given some specifics around, well, it's a sales role, so I want the number one and two, one or two who've done it in two companies, because then it's not a fluke. Actually, you're still, again, selecting out. So it's all about selecting out the people, which is about the skill set, because you want a base level of skill, and then identifying how do you then, which is probably more around the interview, how do you then ensure that culturally they're a fit? And you just, I can't remember, you just mentioned the company that used to do two interviews, one for culture and one for interviewing.
Zappos.
Zappos, that was it. Because I think that's because lots of people do two interviews, but they're pretty much the same sort of interview, but just done two times. I don't think you actually get any particular more out. And they're always generally more skill-based, aren't they, rather than cultural or fit-based. I think when people do two or three interviews, they're always just a bit more in-depth about your skill base. So would you say that doing that also helps? Because if you look in the culture, because obviously most companies are just small, a collection of small or larger teams. And I'm assuming that if you do that, then that helps you build that team ethos. It means that when the person comes in, that they fit more readily into the team because they're all working to the same sort of core values and fitting into that culture.
Yeah. So there's one more thing I would add, since you said your folks like practical stuff, is this is what I recommend to all my clients, is that you create a bench. So the way to attract the right people and is to find the right people is go to LinkedIn or go wherever, and before you need them, so figure out what your critical roles are in your business. Before you need them, start to establish those relationships with people and say, hey, you know, I'm doing this. This is what we do. I just wanted to meet you. You have a great resume. You know, we don't have anything open now, but I just wanted to get to know you and get you to get to know us, et cetera. And that's a good way to also, once you do that, maybe have coffee or lunch, and over time they'll relax, and then you'll see the right person. And then you'll see, you know, before you need them. And the people say, well, I don't have time to do that. I said, look, just do 1 hour once a month. And that's all you're doing, right? And it's either reaching out to people or actually going having coffee or doing a Zoom call if they're remote or whatever. And you consistently do that every month. You're doing that 12 times a year. And, you know, if you're on a team, if you're a team lead, you probably only have two or three critical roles. So, you know, if you have two or three people on the bench and, you know, what you're doing is a critical role is obviously you lose them. That's one thing. But those critical people probably are going to get promoted or move to another part of the company or take your job or whatever, right? So you're finding those places where you can have the relationship ahead of time. It's just much easier to do that, right? It's, you know, you're sort of sharpening the saw kind of thing. So that's a practical thing to do. And I just say, look, just block it on your calendar, you know, pick usually the slowest day of the week or the slowest day of the month, and just pick 1 hour, and that's what you do for that hour. And that's it. And once the hour's up, you're done. Then do it again next month. And you do that over time, you'll be able to attract because you've already found them. If you will. It's much better to do it before you need it than when you actually need it. And now that I said that, I forget your question.
I can't remember what it was either. But just to pick up on that one, and I'll probably circle back. But I think, because I use lots of sporting analogies in my own mind because I like sport. And it's interesting that you said that, because that's what you do in it. If you're managing any sort of football franchise or any sort of sporting franchise, you don't wait till someone's contract's run down or you've lost that key starter before you start looking, do you? You've always got almost like as you said, a bench where you're thinking, right, well, there's two players over there, or there's a player over there who could replace that guy. So you're always ahead, even when you don't think that person necessarily going to leave. Because if you've got good people in your organization, as you said, they're going to leave in one shape or form, whether that's out the door or upwards. So I think that's a really important. Well, yeah. So having said that, I've now remembered the question. The question was about bringing teams together and ensuring that when somebody comes in, they fit nicely into that team.
Yeah. So what I've come to believe is that culture attracts the right people, right? If you're doing the things we're talking about, if you're really putting the culture out there and say, this is who we are, et cetera, and you're living those because and they're coming to you because people talk about you, right? Either your customers, your clients, your employees, et cetera. That's how you're tracking them, because you're living this and like, this is such a great place to work, or I've heard it's such a great place to work. That's the best way to do it. But so I think culture attracts, but it doesn't retain people. And I'll give a short story about this. I was working with a client, and I was talking about this with them, about culture and teams, et cetera. And I said, often what happens is culture will attract, but the team culture is the thing that retains the employee. Many people will stay at a crappy culture and company if they're on a great team.
Yeah.
And many people will leave a really great culture if they're on a crappy team. So they'll either try to stay within the culture and move out of the team, but if they can't, they'll leave the company.
Yeah.
And I was telling the story to someone, and someone that I was talking with worked at Bose for many, many years. He said I was at Bose for 12 or 15 years. And he said the culture was horrible at Bose. He didn't like it at all. But the team he was on was great. So he stayed, right? So it's interesting, right? They said all the right things to attract him, but when it came down to it, they didn't live them. But his team was terrific. So I think team is really important. And this team culture will emulate the overall culture, but it will be slightly different. Right. Because it will be those sets of people, and you have to sort of be an okay fit with that as well. So I think there's those two things work hand in hand. I think, you know, attracting them is definitely a great way to do it with culture, et cetera. But teaching your leaders how to attract and craft and build and develop great teams is also something that's super important at a company.
Yeah. No,
we don't do that very well.
Right? It's interesting, because the next question I was going to ask you was around how do you then create that team within a culture that may be slightly different? Because I've definitely worked in organizations where I've created almost like a micro climate by protecting my team from maybe what the CEO is saying. And I've created my own culture, which might be even slightly different from other teams, and people generally tend to stay in that. So from your point of view, how do you do that if you start seeing actually maybe there is a disconnect between the values of the people you've employed and then some of the core values of that overarching culture, just because, you know, the things outside of that are not allowing it to happen?
Yeah. So that's and you did it. Maybe you did it either through learned experience, or you know, through your parents, you know, gave you these things, or whatever, you know, a whole bunch of things. But that is, I think, one of the most interesting and most difficult things to do, because there are so many components to that. So first of all, you know, when I say if you're a team leader, then you should have a vision for your team, right? It may not be the overarching vision of the company, but you say, hey, when we're working really well together, and we're contributing optimally to the success of the organization, here's what that looks like. That's my vision, right? So that's one thing. Okay, great. Now, functionally, how do we do that, right? And what I work with my teams on is, you know, we work on a functional org chart, and we take the overarching stuff, you know, and then we break down into sub functions. So imagine you're the head of the marketing team. So your major contribution to the organization is measured mostly by the quality of the leads you pass to sales, right? So marketing as a function, to me, as a function overall, is to make sales easier.
Yeah.
And you do that lots of ways. You do that through demand generation, which is how most people do it, right? So reaching out and, you know, doing advertising, et cetera. But it's also, what kind of products are you making, and what's the messaging? And have you really done your research on, you know, is there a fit in the market, and, you know, all those kinds of things. So all of those things contribute to making sales easier. We focus much more on the back end of it, right, of demand generation. And that's what we call marketing these days. But to me, that's just a part of marketing. So that's true. So how do you do that? And in many cases, you know, not this doesn't work for everyone, but there are four main functions that sit under marketing for me. One is product marketing, always solving a product, a problem worth solving. And how big is that market? Okay, great. Now we found one. Now we hand it off to product management, who then says, oh, so this is, let me go talk to clients, potential clients, and they sort of craft what is the job that needs to be done. And so what should we build for them to solve this struggle? And then they say, great. Okay. Then they hand it to the development team, and the development team makes it, right? So if we're doing software, they hand it to software developers, et cetera. And then once it's done, then you do demand generation, which is, you know, how do we go out and reach out to these people that we think are the right ones and sell more of these things? So those are the four main functions underneath. And if you think about those functions, they're different kinds of people, right? Someone who's really good at product marketing has a different kind of brain. And thinks about things differently. You know, they think more like an economist or something, yeah. Right? You know, they're this really curious person, and they love doing the research and investigation, try to find these things. But someone who actually develops a product is much more, you know, structured. You know, it's like, oh, there's a process, etc., and they follow it. So someone who's really good at product marketing might not be as good at product development, and this, you know, sort of goes down to other levels as well. So you have to understand the different kinds of functions. And then the different kinds of people, because, you know, we're not well-rounded. People are not well-rounded. We are spiky. We are idiosyncratic. We are really, really good at a few things. We're okay at a number of set of things, and we're really bad at a whole bunch of other stuff. So as a team leader, your job isn't to create them and make them all well-rounded. Your job is to create a well-rounded team made up of spiky people. And I think that's where that culture comes in. And you may have really embraced three or four of the five or six values of that organization you spoke of. And that's where you focus your time and energy. And that worked for your team, right? Those, et cetera. But they knew clearly what their function was, how they knew success. And you as a team leader are trying to take these people who aren't necessarily folks who would hang out together and be friends and work together and get them to work together well, right? I think it's really about being a great parent. Because if you have, especially if you have 2, 3, 4, 5 kids, I don't know if you have kids or not, yeah. But they're different, right? The first one is different than the second one is different, you know, and so you're trying to create this team of people who hopefully get along and do things together, et cetera. And you treat them differently because some are need a little more attention than others, or some are better at things than others and whatever. That's what you're doing as a team leader. And, you know, there's a bunch of research on this where if you just sort of manage it a little bit at a time, you know, say the right thing, prompt somebody, push back on somebody, and it's really sort of intuition and skill. I think all of those things have to fit together to have a great team, which is why I say it's super interesting and super complicated, because, you know, what I just went through was so many, you have to be a psychologist, you have to be a teacher, you have to be, you know, so many different things to be a great team leader. But great team leaders, you know, like we talked about Alan Mulally. Alan Mulally was a great team leader. Abraham Lincoln, yeah. Was a great team leader, right? And there's this book that Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote about him. He said he put together really weird people who didn't like him and he didn't necessarily like, but he knew they were the right people because he knew what he wanted to get done, right? He thought about the future first, right? That's what you have to do. You have to sort of begin with an end in mind to take, you know, Stephen Covey or whomever, and really understand what does that look like? And then, okay, now you back into how do I create a team that, what do I need in that team to make that happen? That's when, if you put those things together, you're much more likely to have success, I think.
No, I agree. And I think the one thing that you mentioned, which I've always done, and probably more by learned experience than necessarily my parents, but it was certainly around that team vision. Because I think once, firstly, having a team vision allowed you to start focusing on the sort of people that you need to achieve that team vision. And then when they come in and the first thing you talk about is that team vision, then I'm not saying it doesn't matter what happens in the culture outside, but at least on their day-to-day practical working experience, they know actually we're here to deliver this for the team. And if you deliver that for the team, that delivers X for the company. And that seemed to get people to buy in to what we were actually trying to do. And I think the other thing you said amongst those points was having that clarity so people know what their expectation is, in the team as well as the company, but also what to expect from me in that circumstance or from the team leader, what they're going to get back from you. And I think, you know, a lot of those basics like honesty, integrity, you know, openness and honesty tend to come out, because when you have that sort of environment, people feel comfortable that they can not only challenge you, but be challenged, grow, and obviously become better in their own roles. And I suppose, because everything we've talked about so far is like, well, in an ideal world, we'll do this and we'll get that, but it's never an ideal world, unfortunately. So what's your advice when you have, you know, you've done everything that we've talked about, you've gone through the process, you've attracted the right people, they've allegedly got the right behaviors, they've come to the team, they're great for the cultural fit, but they're just not performing in their role. So what's some of the tips that you'd suggest there in terms of how do you manage and trying to work and understand that underperformance when you've been through all the things we've just been talking about?
Yeah. Well, so I've found that if you do the things that we talked about, then this scenario hardly ever happens. But let's assume it does. To me, then it's your fault. And either it's your responsibility to fix, because either you hired someone badly, you put them in the, you might have hired for great cultural fit, but you then put them in a role that they wouldn't be successful at. You put an extrovert in a role where he sits at a desk all day and does spreadsheets. You know, he or she is not going to be too happy doing that every day, right? So you're misplacing them in some way, shape, or form. And that's often what happens with C, you know, A players that then turn into C players. We put them in a situation and then they're just not happy. And it's not, we're not allowing them to express their brilliance and be at their best. So you have to understand that. Did you put them in a role that was incorrect? If that's true, then either you got to find a new role for them, or, you know, you have to find them another place to work.
Yeah.
Because and take the blame yourself and move on. But if you didn't do that, then your job is to understand what are the, you know, again, back to the that sort of key function thing. What are the really critical things that people need to do or know how to do or you know, have that ability, skill, or knowledge, and see where they're weak and then help them to grow into that situation, right? Either do the training or do whatever it is you need to do to help them improve in those areas. Or understand, especially if you're a smaller company, understand that, you know what? They're not going to ever be good at that. So either I have to understand that and just say, you know, that's just the way it is. And until we're large enough to have me bring in a new player that will take that portion of their function away from them and do it better, right? So someone who is a writer, et cetera, is not also someone who's going to be really good at doing, you know, sort of process stuff. But because you can't hire too many, they have to do both.
Yeah.
And just understand that. Understand that, you know, you hire them really for their writing skills and you're asking them to do this other thing. So either you prop them up or whatever or it might be. But if that's not true, then you have to, it's to me, there are three things, right? There's ability, there's skill, and knowledge. Ability, you hire for ability. Abilities generally don't change that much, right? So when people talk to me, they say, what is your sort of, what is it, call it superpower now, or this, whatever you want to call it, right? And my brain seems to be really good at puzzles. I like puzzles. And I think that's why I like startups. Startup is just a big puzzle.
Yeah.
And I found it so much fun to do, really hard and difficult and, you know, long hours, et cetera, but, you know, so satisfying. And I still do puzzles. You know, I have my phone. I'm always either doing a New York Times crossword puzzle, or I'm doing the spelling bee, or I'm doing Wordle or whatever. I just love puzzles. And so... So if you put me in a situation where I'm just routinely doing stuff, I become more and more, dysfunctional or unhappy or whatever. And so you have to understand that. Have you caused that problem or not? So I think from that perspective is I love what you said. What you do is that you really have to start with the vision, and, you know, it doesn't have to be elaborate. And I usually say, write it down, because what I would say is if you get those one or two candidates, you're like, these guys look like a good fit. Hand them this thing and say, this is what you're getting yourself into. Are you cool with this?
Yeah.
This is where we're going. Right. So they can also select out and say, I don't really want to do that. I thought this was something else. Same thing with, my CEOs write us a vivid vision, which is a book by Cameron Herold. And it's a 3-year sort of vision, which is somewhere between 4 and 7 pages long. It's a very in-depth vision, and say, look, you know, I just want you to know, this is what we're doing. You know, this is what it's going to look like. This isn't the how to, but this is the what and the why of what we're doing. Want to make sure you're okay with that before you come on, because you'll be miserable if you're not. So I think if there's one takeaway is write that vision, make sure you have it, and you're less likely to have some people join you who aren't a good fit, because you're never going to get in their head fully, right? So, but you're trying to get as much out of, you know, who they are as quickly as you can.
Most certainly. And then just because I've read a lot about, you know, that when you employ people, they need to be, you need to be employing leaders. And I've just been thinking about it, because if that required, because when you're looking at a team, the team, if I, and I'm an English person, so I would look at soccer, and there was a manager of mine that once said, you should look at your team, you know, like a football team. Not everyone's a striker, not everyone's a defender, not everyone's a goalkeeper. So you've all got different players on the team. But when I listen to successful teams, when I look at sports teams and you listen to them speak, even though they're all different in their own ways and have different skills, which is what you were talking about, you know, ability, skill and knowledge, they tend to all be leaders in their own area. So I suppose the question I want to ask, the short question is, how do you recruit for leaders, or how do you develop, not recruit, but how do you develop leaders rather than just, well, you're functional in that role?
Yeah, so this is, so leader and leadership is a word often thrown about, like strategy.
Yeah.
And it has become this sort of just this vanilla word, you know, that someone, I have to come up with seven strategies or whatever. I'm like, yeah, it's really not in the true sense of the word strategy. It's an approach or a method. It's not necessarily a strategy. A strategy is generally the thinking that you do to then employ some sort of plan, a roadmap, et cetera, which are the things you do. And the things inside the roadmap people call strategies, but I don't know if they really are. So I'm a very simple person. I like to look at things as super simple. And to me, a leader, the one thing that all leaders have in common is that they have followers.
Okay.
So a leader is someone who creates followers. Now, you can be an owner of something or an authority of something or a boss, and doesn't necessarily mean you're a leader, right? So that's why I want to sort of differentiate what I'm saying. But forgetting what you want to do is, I think when you treat people like they have value, they have contribution, you ask for their thoughts, and you make an environment where they can be themselves, then you are basically saying to them, I value you and I value what you're going to do here, and I'm giving you autonomy, et cetera. I think then people are more likely to become leaders, right? But most people don't. Shouldn't necessarily be leaders, right? They don't want to be leaders. I worked with a guy who was really good at what he did, and I said, "Well, you know, you want to run a team, or whatever." He's like, "No, I don't want to. I ever want to run a team. I don't want anyone reporting to me. I just want to do my thing, right?" So this sort of push, especially in the last 10 or 15 years, is everyone has to be leaders, etc. I'm like, I don't really know that. I mean, not everybody can be a leader. There's this great work that Margaret Heffernan, I think is her name, did, she did research meta research, and there was this thing about fruit flies, and they bred the fruit flies, or it was chickens, I don't know, it was some sort of whatever, something that went really fast. And so let's say it's fruit flies because they can go really fast, and they bred like the best ones, and they got better and better at fruit flies. But eventually the fruit flies were all of these A players, if you will, or these whatever, and they killed each other. Right? You know, so you need people who are, you know, who are A and moving forward, et cetera. You need followers, you need all these things, right? And sometimes you're a follower, sometimes you're a leader, et cetera. I don't necessarily think that everyone has to be leaders, but what you have to do is give people their brains.
Yes.
Right? You want to create an environment where people are using their brains, right? I took over this marketing group, one of my startups, and the leader of it prior to me was one of the founders, and he was an engineer. And every morning he would have his huddle. And this huddle was great, but it was about, okay, you do this, you do this, you do this, you do this, and let's meet at the end of the day, whatever. And he did this for months, not even years. And then I took over, and I don't do that, right? One, I couldn't. I didn't know how to. I took over marketing. I was a sales guy. And like, you know, I don't really know anything about, I don't know how to write social media. I don't know how to do these things, right? So I said, I can't do that. I said, but I can tell you what I want us to do, right? I want us to be this kind of organization. I sort of did that vision thing, et cetera. And I want you guys to tell me what you need from me and from each other to get your jobs done. And I'll tell you, the first few months, they hated me, just hated me, right? Because like, oh my God, you know, but after time, and they really believed, they saw that I trusted them, and you know, and we would work together, and I had some skills that were helpful, and but I believed in them and I gave them autonomy, and they became a great team and they loved me at the end, right? And I still, you know, up until about 6 or 7 years ago, this was almost 20 years ago, I would be the person that they would want when they were getting a new job. They would always say, here's my reference, right? Which to me was a compliment, right? Because they knew that we did great work and I let them be themselves, right? So I think my definition of what you're saying is let people have their brains back, give them trust, give them autonomy. You have to give them the guidelines and make sure they have the ability, skills, and knowledge to do it. But then you have to do that. Then they'll become leaders. They'll step up, right? I think that's what I mean. You want people to step up. That's what a leader is. And I believe in that situation. But you have to give them that environment to be able to do that. You have to give them that trust. That psychological safety is Amy Edmondson says, right? You have to create that environment. And that starts with you having to create it. Yeah. Right? Being vulnerable, saying, I'm sorry, I make mistakes, I need help. Then I think you'll create leaders.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good distinction to make. I think when I'm talking about footballers or any sports person, that's probably more what I'm talking about is giving them the brain back and independence and autonomy rather than the first definition you gave it in terms of a leader having followers, because you have people in teams who have that autonomy, but they, as you said, the example you gave, they don't want to be managing teams, they don't want to be managing anybody, they just want to get on with the job, be great at the job, have support when required and left alone when required. So yeah, that's probably a better way of describing it. So we've come to the end of the time. So I always ask my guests before they go to give me, you know, if there was one thing that you wanted to leave people with in terms of this topic around getting the right people on board, developing and retaining them, what would that one thing be, that the standout quote that I'll post all over social media?
Yeah, sure. So if you want to be a great team leader, then your job first is to fire yourself from the day to day as much as possible and give that to other people. You know, until you do that, your life will be harder and harder and harder. So fire yourself from the job as much as you can. Find those, you know, find the A players in your group, give them some of your work so they can grow, et cetera, as well. Your job as a team leader should be relatively boring from a day-to-day perspective, because your job isn't anymore. Your job is to think about the future of the team and the future of the company, depending on where you are. And that takes downtime. And the only way to create downtime is to not have, you know, 80% of your time in meetings.
Yes.
You know, it's really sitting around thinking or pulling in data that's useful to you to then help your team or your company. So fire yourself from the day-to-day is sort of my quote.
Oh, that's perfect. So I've got that, fire yourself from the day-to-day. And just one final, I wasn't planning to ask this one, but it just popped in my mind as you were summing up there, because we just talked a lot about interviewing, and then we talked about autonomy and giving people opportunities and fire yourself from the day-to-day. Would you, because there may well be people in your team who are better at interviewing than yourself, would you suggest that you would utilize them in certain circumstances? Because you might just have someone who's just got a real talent for cultural fit type of interviewing type of stuff, where as leaders, we always think that we have to do it because we're the best person to do it.
Yeah, well, I think you answered that question yourself earlier with the receptionist example, right? Is that you eventually employed someone to help you because he or she had this sort of sense about them. And not only the sense, but they paid attention, right? Because they saw how they were acting when they didn't think anyone was looking. So I think that's it. Yeah. You're never going to be great at everything. So, you know, really be humble about yourself and say, look, I'm just not really great at interviewing. You know, you may want to just meet them and just say, you know, whatever, but you're not necessarily going to say you have the final word in the process. I got very good interviewing, so I did that. But there are lots of other things that I wasn't good at. You know, I'm not a big energy guy and whatever. So when I took over the division I was telling you about, you know, where I did this interview stuff, I said to my head of sales, I said, when we have the monthly meeting, this is what I want you to do. I want you to jump on the tables and do all this because I can't do that. But that's important. You know, it's important. So he loved it, right? And he was great at it. And I did my thing. He did his thing. And so you want to understand what you're good at, what you're not good at, and surround yourself with people who are better at you than the things that are important to be good at, but you're not good at. So I agree.
Thank you very much. That's a perfect place on which to end. So Bill Flynn, thank you very much for the time. As I said at the outset, I knew we'd get some practical takeaways, because I mean, I've written a whole page down here well, more than a page in terms of just some of the key things in terms of, certainly we started the outset talking about changing the interview process, which I think is a real key one, and actually doing things differently if you want different results. You know, looking at the core value litmus test, you know, and how do you attract those people? And Bill gave the really good example of Google and that equation as you're going down the highway and then creating a bench. I could go on, but there's loads of stuff there for you to get your teeth into. And then, as Bill said right at the end, you know, if there's one thing you'd leave you with, fire yourself from the day today. So, Bill Flynn, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Akeem. It was fun.
Brilliant. So I know it sounds like I say it after every episode, but I really, really enjoyed speaking to Bill. Some great actionable takeaways. And sometimes I feel it's a bit of a cheat being the host of a show like this because I enjoy myself so much. Because all I do is I find areas of business that I'm really interested in and areas of business that my audience are really interested in. I then go and track down a person who's a specialist in it and I have a great conversation with them. And I take loads of actionable things away from those meetings. So, you know, the core values litmus test that Bill talked about and the interview for values and behaviours and not just skills, which is something that I'm also very keen on, but he elaborated and explained it very, very clearly. And what I always do, as I said, is I take one or two things that I think can make a difference to my business and I implement them. And I'm really hoping that you get as much of it out of it as I do, and you do exactly the same. Just take one or two key things that you think can make a difference and implement them.
Don't forget to check out the show notes at www.thesalesaccelerationformula.com. And as always, subscribe, like, and share with your friends, colleagues, and anyone else who you think may be interested. But most of all, keep the feedback coming so that we can continue to improve and give you more of what you like. Hope you enjoyed this as much as I did, and as I always do, keep listening and keep growing.